Hello everyone and welcome back to Boat Briefing. We've been off air for a few weeks, but I hope you haven't missed us too much. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of super yachting is Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director. This week, well, instead of me talking about it, why don't you tell us a bit about it, Charlotte? Who is this week's interviewee?
Sure. So this week, our US editor, Cecile, interviewed a guy called Dr. Patrick Gruber. So he's someone who spent his whole career focusing on what he wanted to do, which is to displace fossil fuel-based products. So he started with biodegradable plastics, and now he's looking at biosynthetic fuels. And at this point, you're kind of probably thinking, what makes him relevant to yachting? But he's got an interesting goal with his company, Gevo, which is growing very fast. He's trying to achieve a net zero footprint in part by making fossil-free, low-emission fuels. So the interesting part is that his company already makes the jet fuel and gasoline with very low emissions from farm products, including corn, and it could make a biodiesel for superyacht engines to run off without any changes to the engines at all if the demand was there. So he's going to tell us all about that later on.
It's nice to see a Gruber doing good things for the world. The only other Gruber I've ever heard of was Hans Gruber, of course, the notorious villain who battled Bruce Willis for control of the Nakatomi Tower back in 1988. Or even his older brother, Simon Peter Gruber, the older brother of Hans, who tormented Willis in later movie Die Hard with a Vengeance. But that's enough of that. This is supposed to be a yachting podcast after all.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Cecile asked him much about Die Hard. You'll have to listen on, but I suspect there's not a huge amount of that in there. But, you know, who knows? But there's actually been quite a bit of buzz around alternative fuels at the moment, not least hydrogen. We had a big Clubhouse talk on that earlier in the week, with some really inspirational, powerful speakers who are lobbying very hard for it to become the way we power the yachts of the future, basically.
I loved that Clubhouse chat, but at the same time, I couldn't help but be a mildly disappointed, just because I just want the industry just to be able to click our fingers and make hydrogen the fuel, the go-to fuel. But it's obviously it's not as easy as that, and you kind of think, well, hydrogen's like that is the ultimate answer for everything, but you don't consider, at least I didn't consider, all the massive technical hurdles there are still to overcome before we can incorporate hydrogen as a genuine method of propulsion for super yachts.
Yeah, to me it seemed like one of those totally chicken and egg things, and that I'd always kind of known that there were these hurdles to do with either storage and sort of safety issues around the storage, how much space it takes up on board, all of that. But things are further along than I thought, and it's one of those things where if yacht owners suddenly take the plunge and say, okay, let's do it, then that's going to help the development of it, and that's going to move things forward. And with economies of scale, it becomes cheaper. And you can see how it could totally be the answer. But they do need those kind of first tranche of brave owners to take the plunge. But I think that's starting to happen. We've heard of a few lately, I think.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It does take those early pioneers. And we know now that Lursen, and we'll talk a bit more about this later, but Lursen have sold their first fuel cell superyacht, which is really exciting. And also there's whispers about a very innovative Dutch project that hopefully we'll be able to tell you more about in due course. But yeah, so things are happening. But it always seems to me with this kind of technology, it's forever kind of 10 to 15 years off. But it's nice to know there is a bit of momentum now.
Well, I think those guys that we heard on the talk for the first time, that's, you know, hearing people actually from outside of yachting who have experience in other arenas and things. And I think if anyone can kind of push things forwards a bit, it's those guys. They were very convincing to listen to.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I also love this week, you can tell that I've been doing lots of listening to stuff and not much actual work, but I loved listening to that. We had a Boat Talks event this week, which is for all our captains to listen to, and hearing the captain of MY Archimedes and their amazing adventures was just incredible. Like, they saw everything on their trip. They had these incredible pictures of them with northern lights and kind of surrounded by narwhals. I know that narwhals are a big thing at six-year-old birthday parties at the moment. Narwhals are the kind of new obsession for young kids. But it was, when you see these photos, it was just incredible. My internet timed out for a bit of it, and I was gutted because it was just fascinating. I love hearing about these trips.
The photos were amazing, and that was, so the problem was trying to cut them down, really. I mean, there were thousands and thousands from their trips to the Arctic, Antarctic, and Pacific. So we were supposed to talk for 45 minutes. We talked for an hour and a half just because there was so much to get through. So yeah, this was the first boat talks event, the first of three boat talks events. So we're running these for members of our captains and owners clubs in lieu of physical events. Obviously, we still can't do those. So we thought we'd, you know, gather some experts and have them kind of present to these clubs. And so we had Chris Walsh, the captain of Archimedes, and Tim Soper, founding partner of EOS Expeditions. And they talked about Arctic cruising, Northwest Passage, Antarctic, Drake Passage, all that kind of great stuff. Ross Sea, brilliant, brilliant presentations. And also what it's like to cruise in Papua New Guinea and the surrounding islands. Some real, real great insights there. So if you are an active captain of a super yacht or an owner listening to this, get in touch if you'd like to hear that presentation. And we'll have a few more over the coming months. Talking about members of our owners club, I've got a big shout out to the owner of 34 meter Bonetti Star of the Sea, who's in the club. His boat has been providing disaster relief in St. Vincent and the Grenadines after the eruption of the La Soufrière volcano. The boat has been helping ferry response personnel from Canouan to St. Vincent, as well as emergency supplies, including bottled water and sanitary items for the local population. The yacht is normally based at the Bequia Beach Hotel, but for now is very much an emergency relief vessel. And I love that about the super yacht community, especially in the Caribbean. It seems whenever there is any kind of natural disaster or hurricane, some of the first boats on the scene, in fact the first boats on the scene almost guaranteed every time, is a super yacht full of crew wanting to help and supplies, and of course they can make fresh water and all that kind of stuff. So they are actually in practice quite handy relief vessel.
Yeah, well done to them. That's fantastic. I've actually been doing quite a bit of research on the Caribbean for various reasons lately, and I've heard from people, I know a few people that sort of are based in Barbados, and they said that there's loads of this kind of ashy sludge that's drifted over from the volcano and washed up on the shores. Apparently it's everywhere, and it's pretty bad. So if that was on your list for an itinerary, you might want to look into it a bit further. And there was also announced this week, I believe, I was speaking to some people based out in St. Kitts and Nevis. And at the moment, they've got this 14-day quarantine in place if you want to go on land, as so many places have. But the government announced this week that they're hoping they'll be sort of fully opened from the 1st of October, although what that exactly means is slightly unclear at the moment. But basically, the islands are currently issuing vaccinations, and people have been told, like in the UK, there's this focus on kind of herd immunity, and once they get 70% of the population vaccinated, whether that's earlier or later, that's when they'd be opening up. So fingers crossed for that. Anyway, it's always quite useful, I think, to know the dates that when people are aiming to be opening their doors. So beginning of October for that part of the world seems likely.
Yeah, and just a little plug for the website boatinternational.com. There's the team are doing a great job of updating information on that about territory openings and things like that, and quarantine restrictions, and where and when you can and cannot travel. So do head over to the website and have a look.
Something I've been hearing, just going back to Tim Soper of EOS, who you were speaking to this week, obviously helps out with our Yachts for Science program. Something I didn't realise until recently is not only is taking a scientist on board a really great idea from a sort of an oceans philanthropic point of view, but also it can help you get around some of these permits. I know that that's a bit of a slightly dodgy thing to say, but you know, if you want to do something useful, it can also help you get to some of the places you want to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Always consult the experts. That's not bad advice at all. Alrighty, let's discuss the headlines. And Caroline's not here, so Charlotte and I have divvied up the news this week. Why don't you kick us off, Charlotte?
I'm ready. I've been practicing my newsreader voice. So the first story is kind of follows on very nicely from what we're saying at the beginning of the start of the podcast, which is that Lursen has announced the sale of a superyacht powered by fuel cell technology. Very exciting stuff. So Peter Lursen himself announced the sale on the Lursen Live talk show during a conversation about alternative propulsion technologies. He said the owner, who loves technology and new developments, asked the yard to prove the practical value of the fuel cell technology before signing up for the project. Sounds like a savvy owner. He said he wasn't interested in installing a fuel cell for the sake of saying he had a fuel cell. So basically, he wanted to know that it worked. And Lursen managed to show that the technology will allow the owner to spend more than 15 nights at anchor or cruise more than 1,000 nautical miles, both completely emissions free. So very exciting. That's all going ahead and deliveries scheduled for 2025.
Wow, 1,000 nautical miles emission free. That's and that's likely to be a very big boat indeed. So that's fantastic. Well done, Lursen, and well done the owner for pushing for the installation of that technology on his new boat. Meanwhile, Nobiskrug, another German yard, famous for building 142.81 meter sailing yachts, and more recently, the stunning Superyacht Artifact, has very sadly filed for insolvency. The German media reported that the yard has engaged the Neumünster District Court and begun insolvency proceedings. NDR, the German news organization, reports the yard was struggling to overcome critical developments in yacht construction, citing the coronavirus pandemic as exacerbating financial difficulties. Obviously, this is desperately sad news. Nobiskrug, a shipyard of long standing with a great pedigree and heritage. It was founded in 1905 and, as mentioned earlier, has produced some really amazing super yachts, including 92.42 meter Tatoosh, pictures of which you can now see on the website and which we think will be running in the magazine shortly. A really lovely story on that very, very famous super yacht. So yeah, terrible news about Nobiskrug, but fingers crossed for all the workers at the yard and everyone involved in the company that a good resolution can be found to that situation.
Yeah, that's very sad news indeed. Well, in better news, the long-awaited 85-metre explorer Project Victorious has finally hit the water in Turkey. The yacht was launched earlier this month at AK Yachts after first arriving in Turkey in June 2016. Featuring exterior design by Michael Leach Design and interiors by H2 Yacht Design, Victorious first started life 14 years ago in northern Chile as a 77-metre explorer. The keel of the project was first laid back in 2006. After that, the shipyard ran into difficulty and Victorious was bought again and spent 2 years under construction in New Zealand. The project again stalled and was left unfinished until it piqued the interest of a new owner back in 2016. So thankfully, she's now back up and running and sounds very glamorous indeed. Key features include an upper deck cocktail lounge, an observation saloon and dining room, a helipad at the bow and a jacuzzi on the aft deck.
This is one of those mothballed projects that was just kind of sitting unloved for a number of years. So it's great to see that finally back on the water and complete. Lastly, today we have some pictures of an amazing new project designed by Vrijpak NM Build at Royal Houseman on the website now. It's Project 406, and at 52 meters long, it will become, when delivered, the world's largest true sports fish super yacht. This thing is incredible. It has been described as a sport fisher on steroids by Vrijpak. And when you see the pics, you'll understand what they mean. And you can have a look at them now under the Yacht News tab on the boatinternationals.com homepage. The boat will be entirely built in aluminium, will tower 6 decks over the ocean, and has been designed to explore the world's best fishing spots. The owner is very experienced, according to reports, and we can expect delivery of that superyacht in 2023. It's a real mean machine, this boat. Vrijpak are hugely excited about it, as are we. Can't wait to see more updates on that as it's being constructed. And as tradition dictates, we end the podcast, or at least this section of the podcast, with a data story. And it's a good one. The brokerage numbers are in for the first quarter of 2021. Avid listeners of the podcast will know that 2020 was a bumper year for brokerage, particularly the last 6 months, some of the strongest months on record, frankly, just an astonishing performance for the brokerage market. And 2021 has started in a similar vein. 133 superyachts were sold on the brokerage market in the first 3 months of this year, compared with just 91 in the first quarter last year and 87 in 2019. So a spectacular start. So you could, I suppose, speculate that this is all down to pent-up demand from 2020. But as mentioned already, 2020 was a pretty good year. And the numbers don't really support the whole pent-up demand argument. Aside from the second quarter 2020, which did take a bit of a knock due to coronavirus restrictions and lockdowns, only 74 brokerage sales were recorded in the second quarter. The rest of the year was extremely healthy. The third quarter, there was 109 sales in 2020. And in the fourth quarter, 139 sales. Phenomenal performance. And the first quarter of 2021, Well, it's repeat performance, really. Momentum has continued with 133 sales. The average asking price in the first quarter this year was up on 2020's Q1 at €8.99 million compared to €8.39 million the same period last year. Although both those quarters were down on the first quarter of 2019 when the average asking price was €12.54 million. It's worth noting here that asking price is not the same as a final sales price. Obviously, we don't know what the boat actually sold for. That price is never declared, but we do know the asking price. The strongest size categories in the first quarter this year were the 30 to 40 meter segment, which saw 50 sales, about 17 more than Q1 in either 2019 or 2020. And the 24 to 30 meter category was also very healthy with 49 sales, 15 more than last year.
Oh, it's really good news that things are keeping moving. I think in times like these, you sort of worry about the industry grinding to a halt, but clearly the opposite is happening. And it's good to see those kind of boats at the smaller end of the market doing very well as well. So all very positive stuff.
Yeah, it is. And our legendary brokerage editor, Malcolm McLean, who is something of a, well, he's an icon of the CPO industry, frankly. He has trouble keeping pace with the orders, the sales at the moment. I mean, the news is just coming thick and fast. And it's that 30 to 40 meter market is so strong right now. It seems to me if you're a broker with, you know, kind of a 10-year-old, well-looked-after Benetti, I mean, you could flip that in days. It seems like that, at least at the moment. Certainly a good time to be selling boats. Right, that's it for the news and data this week. Stay tuned to hear Cecile's interview with Dr. Patrick Gruber.
Hi. Today we're speaking with Patrick Gruber, who is the CEO of a company called Jivo. And correct me if I'm wrong, but basically, you're making fuel out of carbohydrates. Carbs are good for us. Is that right?
Well, it depends on how many you eat, because they may actually add a lot of fat. Like in the U.S., not so good to have too many carbs. In what we use, we are making a fuel. It's a, it actually starts with CO2 in the atmosphere. It, photosynthesis, plants capture the CO2 and turn it into carbohydrates. And then we have learned how to take those carbohydrates and turn them into drop-in hydrocarbon fuels, gasoline, jet fuel. We can do a diesel fuel. The thing is these are real hydrocarbons. They're high-performing technical fuels. They just drop in. They work with any engine anywhere. It's pretty good stuff. It took a long time to learn how to do this. It's non-trivial to figure out.
Well, that sounds amazing. We'll get back into that a little bit more, but tell us a bit about your background. I read about you, and I mean, you have an amazing background, you know, chemistry, PhD in chemistry, an MBA. My God.
Yeah. You know what? It's a, I grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota, in the Midwest. And, you know, it's a Midwestern place. Agriculture is a big deal there, so everyone's familiar with it. And it's just part of life. I wound up being interested in science since I was a kid. Went to college, learned suddenly that I was good at chemistry. And it is what happened is I took organic chemistry, which is normally the one that breaks the back of people, right? It turned out I naturally understood it. I can't even explain it. It's like a gift from God kind of a thing where I didn't have to work at it. I understood organic chemistry. It made sense to me. So I could do exceedingly well without trying very hard. It was a natural thing. And of course, being the lazy youth that I was, I just went with what was natural. And that took me down the path of chemistry, and because I could get fellowships, and that's how I got to graduate school, is I got fellowships, and so I could get paid to go to school. And I'm like, whoa, that's a good deal. And so I went and did that. And one of the things that I had set and wanted to do is I was interested in displacing fossil-based fuels and chemicals because they pollute. And I grew up at an age when I remember the first Earth Day. I remember that day. It made an impression on me. It stuck with me. And, you know, it makes sense. You know, we shouldn't wreck the earth. And so it's all, you know, that was on my mind. All those kind of things were on my mind at the time.
Interesting. I read like most teenagers or young people, you had a muscle car, right?
And I did. I had this absolutely beautiful 1970 Dodge Challenger RT with a 440 Magnum in it. Man, that thing, it was so fast. It was unbelievable. Now, it had a really small gas tank, so I really could really drive really fast from gas station to gas station. Now, when gas back in those days went from 25 cents to a buck a gallon, that was a problem. And you remember there was a gas crisis in about 76 or 77 in the United States where people really were not used to not, you know, there was a shock to have to stand in line to get gas. Well, that was a particular problem, and I could no longer afford to drive my car. And so one day a fellow said, "That's a nice car you have there. Can I buy it?" And I said, "Well, I can't afford to drive it. I'll sell it to you." And I thought I was being, he was good, but it stuck with me because this showed the dependence of us on fossil resources. So that's when the idea first got in my head that, gosh, I wonder if there's a technology that we could use to get off the dependency of fossil fuels. So I wasn't so much thinking about it from a green point of view then. It was simply the case of, what the heck, you know, we don't have enough energy, and what's this oil stuff? So I started thinking about it and learning about it then.
Okay, great. But then I saw that your first endeavor in trying to free yourself from petroleum-based products was plastics. And you work with a major American company, and you can tell us about that, developing these, shall we say, green plastics?
Yeah, they're green plastics for sure. They're actually, it's a wonderful success story. It's only taken 20 years. No, actually, it was better than that. It went faster. But in what happened is I was hired by Cargill, the big agri-processing firm, to do new products made from renewable resources with the mission of displace petrochemical-based chemicals, plastics, and fuels. And I was turned loose to go figure it out. Now, you can imagine me as a young PhD student. I didn't have an MBA yet. Cargill sent me to MBA school because they knew I didn't know enough. Okay, they were smart. That was a good thing for them, and it was good for me. And so, but they did turn me loose, and they set up meetings. And so I actually had the opportunity, a rare opportunity. You know, remember, I knew nothing about industry. I got there. They said, well, here's a P&L, a profit and loss statement. I'm like, what do I do with that? Well, you got to raise money to go do your projects and figure it out. I'm like, okay, so it's an entrepreneurial thing. I have to go pitch projects internally. And they said, well, go to figure out the chemicals, figure out what we should make from carbohydrates or renewables. Okay. I don't know anything. So you start asking questions, and, you know, I'm kind of fearless at that stuff at times. And the senior executives at Cargill set me up with senior executive meetings at chemical companies and plastics companies. So I'd go, and you can imagine me, you know, this is the day when I really do have a notebook. So if you were redoing the chemical industry, what would you do different? And they would say things like, oh, you cannot use the chemicals we did. You cannot do the side streams that we did. You have the EPA to deal with. You'll never get regulatory approval. So your stuff has to be clean on every front. You can't emit, you know, toxic chemicals, and there's this long list. And so I went around and interviewed everybody, and then they told me what to do. They'd always end it with, oh, you'll never be successful, but this is how you would have to do it. You've got to become equivalent performance. You got to deliver, because these products are in the marketplace. You know, things have to work. They got to be economical. You can't, in the production process, it has to use standard stuff. You can't do exotic new things because that would add 20 years to a timeline. And so I actually made a list like this, and it's no joke list, and wrote it down. And then one day, and I've been reading all about all kinds of technologies that could be used. And then one day I had an idea of how to make this plastic called PLA. And I was walking through the lab, and all of a sudden I knew how to do it.
What is that? Polylactic?
Polylactic acid. So it's a plastic that's made from lactic acid. And, you know, interesting, there's a fellow named Wallace Carruthers who invented nylon. Okay, so I'll divert for a minute, but he invented nylon, and the product he worked on prior to that was trying to do a polylactic acid. Now, what he found is that he could never get it to be a plastic. He could do the chemistry with it, but it always have problems and vaporize. And I knew of his work. And this is where it's so weird, because of the work I did in graduate school on my research thesis, I knew how to do some analyses that were kind of sophisticated. So when I thought about his stuff, I know what his problem was, and I could go sort it out and figure it out, and then how to capture it. So we thought of making a lactic acid plastic. So what you have to do is connect all the lactic acids together, but you can't just do it in a normal way. If it's heating it up and boiling away all the water and making things connect together, you have to go through some tricks. And also we need to control the properties. You control the properties by chain length, how many of these lactic acids are hooked together, and then are they right-handed or left-handed? You have to be able to control that in the sequence of them. And I suddenly knew how to do that. And it's just this weird thing where I knew how to do it one day. And then it was like, okay, proving it and then developing the process, building it up and commercializing it. And so we're able to make films and fibers and paper coating and cups and things like that.
And it's all biodegradable.
It is. It's compostable, biodegradable. It is. And it has the properties that you'd expect. Lots of people have seen it. It's this, you most often would recognize it for the beer drinking crowd, a clear cup with a green band on it. I have the very first ones here in my house.
And that's always was St. Patrick's Day, but no.
That's right. Everybody had St. Patrick's Day today. That's right. Yeah, it's fun, you know, and it was one of these things where I don't know where the insight came from other than all of a sudden I was given it and I knew how to do it from front to back completely what to do. And it was one of these insightful moments I had. But it was because so many people taught me stuff and were courteous enough to give me the time of day telling me what to do, what not to do, how to do it. And I processed it, I guess, and it came to me.
Now, I read somewhere, I don't know if it's true or not, but it's awfully good story that you cooked the first batch of this polylactic plastic in your kitchen.
I did. I actually had those samples are still here in the house. And what happened was that I had to go talk to senior executives to get money. So there was this next day, I don't remember what day it was, but let's just say it was a Tuesday. And on Wednesday, I had to go give this presentation and beg for money. Say, hey, give me the money. I need to go do this plastic stuff. You know, and I'm talking to people who are like, they know what plastic is vaguely, but they haven't really thought about it or how to make it. And you got to show them that, no, I can take renewable resources and turn them into plastic. So I got lactic acid. And at the time, I didn't really have a lab. And so I just did it at home and made the stuff. And I made, you know, I made a bunch of fibers and I made some film so people could see how films look like for wrapping, you know, like those clear films. And I did, you know, some paper coating, you know, took some paper and coated it so it's waterproof and things like that. And so it was enough to show people. So I got my first internally invest. Cargill, the executive, said, okay, well, that seems like a reasonable idea, you should investigate further. And I got my first money that way. So that's what happened to it. Yeah.
Okay, well, you know, we have such a plastic problem nowadays in the ocean and everywhere. You kind of wonder why this is not everywhere, right?
Well, you know,
it sounds like a dream come true, something that
it does. And what's the thing is that plastics, you think about how good they are and what they do. They protect what's inside, like food. Without it, guess what? Food spoils.
Sure.
So there's a lot of really good things they do. It's this balancing act always. And this is a bigger problem of sustainability and how to think about sustainability anyway, is that it's not all one or the other. There's proper uses of plastic. What's better? We couldn't ship stuff as far if we didn't have plastic. It would, you know, what do you do? How do you do it? And yet, there are times and some things that are very difficult of... they're going to be disposable. So ideally, you'd want to minimize the use of plastics and use reusables, ideally, right? That is an economic trade-off. And this gets to a bigger problem around sustainability. People will talk, but what will they do? It costs more. It costs more to go ahead and recycle. It takes more effort by people. And so how important is it really? And this is a very important lesson that we learned that impacts my work at Gevo. Back in those days, is that people will say, I want this, I want that, and it's great. Oh yeah, you're gonna pay a little more for it? Really? Are you gonna you're gonna take it and drop it into a compost pile? We did in Austria. I don't know if some people will be old enough to remember, but when they originally did the our first composting trials were you separated the plastics, were in Austria. We set those up and did them. And it worked great, but we could get Austrians to do that. You know what? Try that in America. Not so simple. You know, they're like, what? I got to put another bin, really? And so we did set it up. I live in Boulder, Colorado, and Boulder, Colorado is one of the first places that set it up. So it's always fun to see the place here that we originally did the work here in the States.
That's great. Well, how did you go from these this plastics, and you set up a company that still exists today, right?
Yeah, the how did I go from the plastics to what we're doing now?
To Gevo, yes.
Yeah. So what happened is that we got the plastics plant built, and you know, I'm a person who likes to do new things and I like to push the edge. And I was the guy at Cargill who looked at new technologies and developed stuff. And I'd looked at lots of technologies and how do you convert renewable resources and do them sustainably and make and displace some kind of a hydrocarbon product. But I wanted to do something big. And but I hadn't seen something new in a long time. And I kind of got bored. And then I thought maybe I'll go take a job as being a CEO. So I took a job as Outlast Technologies, which is a fiber technology. And I did that for a couple of years, and I was getting rid of my non-competes and things like that. And then, but I was still doing some consulting work around the field. There's one company out there that was VC-backed called Gevo that had been, they've been wanting to reboot it. And people knew of me because I had won a lot of awards and things like that. And so I'm a fairly well-known person. And, you know, I was recruited to come be the CEO. Richard Branson's group, Virgin Green Fund, recruited me along with Vinod Khosla, one of the famous VCs. They recruited me to come take over Gevo and reboot the company. And I turned loose to go make it successful. What I want to do is hydrocarbons, drop-ins. It's this. What if we can eliminate the carbon footprint of gasoline and jet fuel itself, or diesel fuel itself? Eliminate it on a net zero basis. So think of the whole cycle of it, capturing the CO2 and then make it into something and then burning it. Eliminate the footprint on a net basis. But in order for it to be adopted, it must be the same. It must be a drop-in. Otherwise, this is the lesson we learned in plastics. Any slight changes screw up the distribution system, right? Okay. So it has to go into the pipelines, the pumps, the tanks, the trucks, the engines, the combustion engines, with no change. Consumers, you know, they don't like to change very much either. And so the easier you can make it get into their system of just dispensing it, the easier, so they can just use it. So that's what we were working on. And then we had an idea that we could use this combination of biotechnology plus chemistry to solve that problem and make it work. And so that's what we've been working on ever since.
So what does Gevo make nowadays? What type of fuels? And
yeah, we make hydrocarbons. So the hydrocarbons are the big classic category of gasoline, diesel fuel, jet fuel, things like that. We focus our efforts on gasoline and jet fuel because we can make the most money by doing that, because those are the ones that are some of the biggest problems that people identify. The technology itself is kind of interesting, the way we developed it. And this is, again, one of these where gasoline is primarily made of carbon chains that are 8 carbons long, okay?
Take your word for it.
They're 8 carbons long. Jet fuel has 12 carbons in a chain, okay? Diesel fuel has more like 16 carbons in a chain. So we're like, 4 carbon building block. We could use a 4 carbon building block. Where could we get one of those? We're scotch drinkers. And we smell, and chemists, so we smell these Islay scotch whiskeys and go, hey, that's isobutanol. There's a chemical called isobutanol in there. Isobutanol is an alcohol that is made naturally in brewing or in making whiskey or something. And it's a little bit of an alcohol mixed with a whole lot of ethanol, standard alcohol. But isobutanol has 4 carbons. We're like, gosh, what if we could take a yeast that would normally make ethanol and change the pathways inside that organism to no longer make the ethanol and instead eat sugars and make our alcohol that has 4 carbons? Because then if I had those 4 carbons, I can do simple chemical steps, hook them together to make my gasoline to get 8 carbons. Or if I hook 3 of them together to make jet fuel. So that's what we did. It just took us a long time. It worked. It took a massive amount of biotechnology work because, you know, you got to keep, it's a yeast. This is like the yeast you would do to make ethanol in a brewery. We genetically engineered it to, it's still a yeast. It's still natural the way we did it. We had to find all the natural components from other ones and then rearrange things inside the cell, inside the yeast, so that it eats the sugars and makes this isobutanol at a way that would work at a commercial scale. So taking that, doing the biotechnology, scaling it up, proving it works, proving the economics, all good. And then, of course, that's part one. Part two is you got to convert it into hydrocarbons, the jet fuel and gasoline, and then prove it to works to everybody, because that's paradigm breaking. Who are, what, a high performing renewable resource based fuel? What's that about? And oh, and ours has, like, our jet fuel, higher energy, no sulfur, no particulates, gasoline, no particulates, no sulfur, no nitrogen. So it's more pure. So these are big deals for people, right?
And most we can solve definitely. These things. Yeah.
Right. And so proving out the economics, getting people aligned in the marketplace. So here's one of the things that our technology has been working for quite a while. It's the marketplace that's now developing. For many years, oil price used to be high. When oil price was $140 10 years ago, you know what? Boom, we could commercialize this.
Right.
Well, oil price went down to 40. And everyone's interest said, it's like, hey, if you could match the same price of a petrochemical product made from a barrel of oil, well, great, I'll buy it. I'm like, wait, you want me to deliver to you a value-added product that solves a problem for you in the marketplace and not pay me for it? Is that what you're saying here? Well, I don't like it when you phrase it that way, but yeah, that's what, like, all right, well, no, we're not doing that. And so we spent our time working on specialty and niche applications, which is, you see us working with Haltermann Carless, a German company, doing specialty fuels, and they've been supplying the racing circuits in Europe with our gasoline products. We've been doing demonstration products around the world with jet fuel, because you got to get, everyone used to the idea that these things really do work well. So we've been doing that. And then we had been working on getting these big customer contracts. We finally started to achieve that in the last, say, little over 12 months in the last year. And this is because companies now believe that they're going to be held accountable for their carbon footprint, right. Their fossil carbon footprint.
So tell me about those fuels that you make. Well, is it correct to say it's a biofuel?
It is a biofuel, but I hate using that term because biofuel conjures up images that it doesn't work. It sucks in terms of its properties.
Yeah, why does biofuel have a bad image? What's the problem?
Well, part of it is because there's a variety of reasons. So part of it is because of they got pushed out early. They're originally biodiesel, for example, and biodiesel itself has trouble with certain kinds of properties like freezing temperatures or crystalline temperatures and things like that. Mm. So it gum up engines sometimes. And you have to process it carefully for that not to happen. So it got out in the marketplace and not everyone was equally careful. With ethanol, particularly in the marine industry, people hate it because ethanol is completely miscible with water, meaning they mix together. So if you have ethanol and gasoline, water moves into it, and then you start to get other issues. Right. And if you don't drive your boat very often, then you start to build up more water. That becomes a problem. It gets corrosion, and you can also get like backfiring and blow out gaskets or heads or stuff like that. I've done that a couple times myself. So those are the kind of things that happen. And so the idea that one solution is good for all things, this is, again, another one of these other wrong paradigms. It's not. You design something. This is back to these first principles that people taught me when I was asking the questions in my notebook. Design it for use, the fitness for use, for the proper use. Well, look, it's a gasoline engine. What should you put in the engine? How about gasoline? Oh, it's a jet engine. Do you think that everyone's going to change all jets if you make something new? No, they're not going to do that. It better be jet fuel. So instead, you make gasoline and you make jet fuel. And now people make renewable diesel too.
And you don't have to change.
You don't change anything. This is the point. It would never be adopted if it wasn't just a straight drop-in. It has to go in straight. But that's part of the magic of the technology that we did. And we're not that creative. Like I said, we go gasoline. Let's see, that's 8 carbons long. Jet fuel is 12. We need a 4 carbon building block. Where do we get them? We're sitting at a bar. Hey, that's isobutanol. It's got 4 carbons. I wonder if. And that's how the creative process goes.
So, but the two main targets at the moment are jet fuel and gasoline, which you can use in cars or boats. So are you working with some boating companies at the moment? Or
we have people are interested in isobutanol to displace ethanol as well. So we can do that. We have done a lot of work with the NMMA on that because it makes it has very nice properties as well as a fuel. And so some places require that you have oxygen in the gasoline. So in those places, isobutanol is the preferred and recommended oxygenate. So think of that one as an additive. Mm. But on the mainstream gasoline, yeah, we've been working with folk, and we like the marine industry. So when we do gasoline, it is, think high-octane gasoline. I like all these outboard engines. They need high-octane gasoline. Let's go. And you know what? Some of these big turbines, I understand, need kerosene, right? Well, that's what jet fuel is. You know, we know how to do that. And, you know, we also know how to make renewable diesel fuel. We just haven't focused on it yet because so many others are working on that using a different kind of technology. We're the only ones really doing gasoline and a mixture with jet fuel.
So you could actually put some of these synthetic diesels into a marine engine on a yacht.
Could. Yep.
You could?
No problem. Yep, you could. So these things will work in those applications. The tricky part in the marine industry with the yachts or anyone else is who exactly is the customer? Who is it really? Is it the energy company who's trying to distribute? Is it the marina, you know, or the port? Or is it the yacht owner who's the customer? Right. Well, you know, and the thing is, it's all of them to a degree. But you know where the voice of the customer starts is with the owners. The owners have to demand it, because otherwise you're left with situations like we saw in the U.S. where one marina will take it on, right? But they're worried about, will people come to my dock to fill up or go to down to the next marina to fill up, right? It's this balancing act because it's new. What we need is a strong voice of the customer in the marketplace demanding that we do something about these fuels. And the thing is, the technologies do work. This isn't even a question. They do work. Getting them to market's hard because you got to organize the channels to market, right?
I understand.
But that's all doable stuff. So if, like, first, I love boats. I love big boats. I love big boats. I do. I've never had yacht type big boats, but
not yet.
Not yet. Someday maybe, you know. Okay, and mine will probably have a sail, I admit. But hey, but it's a, these are, it works. It works. These are high octane. So think of it, our gasoline that we put in, it's 100% octane. 100% octane, 100 octane.
And in terms of emissions, how do they rate?
Yeah, they have very low, they don't have any sulfur, nitrogen, and stuff like that, and so they don't have the same kind of pollutants. So it'll depend upon how that engine is operated or what's done or which engine specification, because sometimes you can get NOx and SOx from those things, but it's not from our fuel. And then in terms of the carbon footprint, it's a net zero potential. So we still have to go build our big plant. It'll be, you know, it's still 2 years away, but as we design it, we're eliminating all of the fossil energy. So it's going to be an off the grid plant. That's an unusual thing to do.
Right.
Why? We fully know that electricity and natural gas and oil account for 73% of all greenhouse gas emissions on the earth. Well,
that's,
you know, it is. And so electricity, how is it made? Well, that's from burning coal. It's from burning natural gas. It's dirty on most places in the world. And so it's the minority of stuff that's renewable. Okay, I have to run a plant. I have motors that are electric. I have, you know, I got to make steam. That's heat. And so we're doing renewable natural gas, generating ourselves from residual agricultural stuff. We also are doing a project around dairy manure, capturing the manure, digest it, and make it into renewable natural gas. By the way, we also get out of that fertilizer that can go back to the fields, which is kind of nice. And then we are doing renewable electricity, putting up wind towers. We'll use some of our biogas to generate electricity on site. So these are all things that we do, but it's all about, we're trying to design a plant that is like the most state-of-the-art plant on earth to be off the grid. That's what we're doing. And it's going to make these renewable resource-based hydrocarbon fuels. And you know what? You do all, that project is big. It'll produce 45 million gallons of hydrocarbons. It's going to also produce 200,000 tons of high protein animal feed. That's more, it's almost twice as much on a tonnage basis of protein than it is of the hydrocarbon itself. We'll also make some vegetable oil too. It's like 30 million pounds, or, you know, 15,000 tons roughly.
So what's the source material?
Corn is the raw material in the Midwest, U.S., but really the way we think of it in a global scale is this carbohydrates and sugar residues are the thing that we're interested in. Because corn is grown primarily for its protein content, most people don't even know that, but it's the protein that's useful in corn. If you feed too many simple sugars to a cow, they burp.
Methane.
It makes methane. Everybody complains about the greenhouse gas footprint of cows. Well, you know what? How about we stop feeding them simple sugars? They're not good for them. And the farming side with corn, lots of people have this paradigm that, ooh, farming's bad, pollutes the earth. Yeah, you know what? I don't know what data y'all looking at, but that's not actually what happens in the Midwest U.S. And in the Midwest U.S., they use these practices called low-till and no-till. What these are is special planting equipment, cultivation equipment. They would, in a field, you know, you after one season, they chop the corn stalks off, for mm-hmm. example. Then they would dig a small strip in between what's grown there and plant the seeds in. The reason they do that is it builds up soil carbon, it builds up nutrients, it saves them money. So the farmers learn to do this not so much because they're trying to be sustainable. It's because they can make more money doing this by building up soil carbon. So this time nature is working with good agriculture practices and making money.
Yay.
So, and the no-till ones are even more, that's even better equipment. They just cut it down and they have a drill that punches a hole in and drops the seed in along with the fertilizer. And you know, the other thing that they've done is everyone uses precision agriculture. So that meaning it's GPS prescriptions, like every square meter of land gets a different dose of whatever it is because no one wants to waste excess chemicals. And so it's just not done the way that, you know, unless you're kind of used to this in the Midwest, you would not know that it's done this way. But what that happens then is that the soil carbon is actually building in the Midwest U.S., and the amounts of fertilizer and nitrogen are being decreased. And so that's a pretty interesting thing. So we like that because agriculture itself, done right, offers a great route to capture carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, even over and above. Because if we pay a farmer to use better practices, he's building up more carbon in the soil than shows up in the corn product itself.
That's great.
Now, around the world, though, it's any kind of carbohydrate. We always care about where did it come from exactly? I got to know. How was it grown? Like sugarcane. Okay, sugarcane. People will ask me, why didn't you use sugarcane? We can use sugarcane. We can use sugar. We can use molasses. Now, how are you going to balance out that land that sugarcane is grown on doesn't generate any protein that helps nutrition and solve world hunger? I get that it makes sweet tooth feel better. I get that part. And so there's all these kind of conundrums that we have when we work in the sustainability field that have to be addressed. And, you know, the fact is we were the first to make jet fuel from wood. From wood. So you can break down cellulose, the actual woody part of a plant, break it down into sugars, and then turn them in with our process to make jet fuel and gasoline. And we were the first, we flew an Alaskan Airlines flight a couple years ago to prove a point because it's not that hard. I just need the sugars from wood. I will buy the sugars from wood. Anybody want to make them for me? I will buy them. Just deliver them, prove the sustainability, prove that they work for the environment and prove that they're economical. I'll buy.
You know, this amazes me because, you know, for the last few weeks, I've been kind of researching alternative for propulsion for motor yachts, alternative fuel, and so on, and came across your company in the process, and then we talked the first time, and I was quite amazed at what you were telling me, because everybody seems to be trying to reinvent the wheel right now, and there's a tremendous rush, or interest, I should say, in hydrogen, for example.
Yeah.
How do you explain that? I mean, it seems like you have a perfectly workable solution here, unless I'm missing something.
Part of it is that people have to understand it. So this is a trick, right? Because we span from, you know, growing stuff, appreciating why photosynthesis is good. Have you ever thought about the miracle of photosynthesis? Here, think about this.
Pretty amazing.
Carbon dioxide's at 425 ppm in the atmosphere. 425 parts per million. If we're going to do chemistry with it, how do we get that collected and concentrated into a bottle so we can do something with it as a liquid? Well, guess that's what, in essence, photosynthesis does. They do it by capturing it using sunlight energy, applying it, and mixing it into a carbohydrate. That's an amazing thing unto itself. All right? Think of the amount of energy that takes. You know, a gas, releasing a gas, you know what that does, right? Big energy release. So someone has to concentrate it and put that energy back in. So plants are doing a lot of the work. In the fermentation, we're doing work there too, using, again, the renewable carbon to provide energy. And so that helps in the production process. It's why our stuff becomes economical. Then use renewable electricity, renewable natural gas, we get there. When people are looking at hydrogen, hydrogen has potential in a lot of applications, and I think there's a lot of potential in light-duty vehicles, for example, and things like that. It makes a lot of sense in certain locations. But this, again, is one of these things where it works great in some places. It's not the ubiquitous answer for all places. I would say the same thing about EV. In fact, I just got a new car that is EV here, and it's a hybrid, but it can run EV. And, you know, it makes sense to have... It's not one answer or the other. It's in all these things are required. Think about this. Energy, the use of energy worldwide is 73%+ of all greenhouse gas emissions. We must solve energy. We need all solutions. Bring on the EV, bring on the hydrogen. Now back to your question. Here's some practicalities. The density of a fuel like ours is energy density is 4 times greater than a liquid hydrogen. 4 times. To deliver the same amount of energy. Hmm. So, I don't know. People have been unaware. There's, I think, of products like ours that are designed to do this. There's this question of the business systems that go with it. So, engine manufacturers, I'm sure, look at things and go, I wonder if I could make more money by making a hydrogen engine because I get to make new engines then. So, I think hydrogen has potential in certain applications, but it's for things where... In the displacement of where energy-dense liquids have been used, I don't think that's the right solution. Light-duty vehicles makes a lot of sense, you know, or especially when combined with fuel cells or something. But, you know, the rest, our stuff works. We need to make people aware that it works and is available and can be done. What we do need is a customer who says, hi, I would like to do it, and I'm willing to pay you for the evaluated properties you deliver. That's actually harder to find. Mm. Think about it this way. In the gasoline and jet fuel space, and also in the renewable diesel space for transport on road use, there's enough carbon value credits that are available from various programs at the state level or federal level or at the national levels in Europe where you can get paid for that. That's actually how a company like us would make money. That doesn't exist in the marine industry.
Right.
That needs to get organized, and if I'm in the marine industry, everyone should say, we want that same kind of credit applied to our engines, applied to our fuels. Then we can go ahead. Then I think it would become economical. Otherwise, our stuff would have to be at too great of a premium where people don't want to pay.
Right. Is there much testing to be done, though? I mean, let's say, you know, for example, companies move towards, you know, hybrid systems or diesel electric or whatever solutions to move ships and boats around. But there is a big fleet of boats equipped with combustion engines. So if we wanted to say, well, for these boats that exist, we can use synthetic diesel like yours. What's the barrier there? Is there much testing to be done?
No, we'd have to, you know, there's like right now there's renewable diesels are available. They work really good. And so they're made for, they don't use our technology. It's a different technology, but they work. They're available. And then as we do ours, it'll be the same thing, but they meet a spec for diesel. So diesel's diesel. Just drop in.
Okay. All right.
And so it's one of these things where it is, I think it's an economic question is the problem, is that the production cost of something like ours probably costs at least 50% more, maybe depending upon what exactly we're comparing it to. And bunker fuels are the lowest of low in terms of value in a barrel of oil. And so those things, that's why they're so dirty, by the way, is that they're the kind of the bottom of stuff. And so are people willing to pay 2x, 3x? Well, and the answer is generally no. This is back to what's the sustainability worth really question. And of course, in the gasoline space and on-road use in general, and we're seeing it spread to the airline space or jets, the governments are stepping in and saying, you companies are held accountable and have to do it. And this is what California did so successfully. they set up low carbon fuel standard. Companies are accountable for their carbon footprint. They have to buy stuff, you know, to balance themselves. And then companies who generate renewable energy get the credits for that because they're saving fossil carbon, and they have a very good system of measuring who does what, and it balances out and works. You know, the oil companies would say, well, we don't like it. Not all of them, they're changing now, but they don't like it because it costs them more money, sort of, right? But depending upon how they view themselves and where they play in the supply chains, and are they involved in renewable energy at all? So the world is changing slowly. In the marine space, I don't know of anyone, you know, I haven't seen laws or anyone where it's supporting defossilization in a monetary way so that people like us could say, that's a good target market segment. I like it. I can make as much money doing that as something else. And I think that's the real problem.
There's also a cost of not doing the right thing, right? And there's also the perception that is very important in yachting as well. Yeah.
And who's going to step up then and say, you know what, I'm willing to take that on and get it, or, you know, I'm willing to take it on and pay. Will someone drive their yacht up and say, yeah, I'm willing to pay twice as much for that diesel fuel? Will they really?
If it's clean fuel, it allows to meet emissions.
I would love to see that. I would like to believe that. And I'd like to believe there's enough of them so we could put it in enough of a big place and big tanks and supply it somewhere. I'd love to believe that. But I tell you, my experience with doing the plastics was people say that they won't do it because whoever it is that has to fill up the tank has a budget. And that whoever that captain is has got a budget. And he's held accountable for meeting the budget. And so somebody senior has to say, I'm going to expand your budget, but it better be fulfilled with, you know, it's stuff like that. That's the real practical issue.
But we do have to meet the problems that we have, so
we do. We'll solve them. I think part of it is making people aware. What I'd love to see is I'd work with, you got some yacht owners who want to work together, I'll work something and we could do it. We do that. Heck yeah, we'd even recruit, make a consortium of people to do it to prove the point that it can be done, and we can quit screwing around with stuff. This stuff can be done. So it's not, we're zealots, by the way. You can tell from talking with us, and we're zealots because we know it technically can be done. It's a matter of working the economics out, working the distribution out, working the practicalities out. But we need a complete supply chain. Who wants it? This is the big question.
Well, let's try to get the word out there.
I'll work with you to do it. I'll be glad to.
Okay. Well, that sounds good. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, pleasure. Thank you so much.
And we'll keep in touch, see where you go with it.
Yeah, anytime you call. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Ed Cavendish and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.